casa.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Allison. So I'm going to jump right into things here. As you know, there have been student protests against the war in Gaza. It's been big news in the United States and now here in France.
Yeah, especially at the political science institute known as Sciences Po. Mm-hmm. There have been protests in Paris and on its campuses around the country.
Yeah, some are calling these protests here a mirror of what's happening in the U.S., but I'd say it's developed in parallel with, you know, similar concerns about university ties to Israel, but the scale and the scope and the politics are all a bit different.
Viva, viva Palestina! Free, free Palestine!
I went to Sciences Po this week, where students were gathered in front of the entrance of the main campus. There's lots of chanting and speeches.
Today, it's mainly blocking the street to show, to have visibility.
That's Louise. She's wearing a black and white keffiyeh scarf. She's on the edge of the crowd of the people holding Palestinian flags and signs about Rafah, the city in Gaza that Israel was planning to attack. This was on Tuesday. Louise started a master's in political science this school year and got involved in the protest movement as soon as it started organizing, soon after Israel started bombing Gaza following Hamas's attack on Israel on October the 7th. The protests hit a tipping point last week when the university president asked police to forcibly remove several dozen students who had set up encampments inside the university's main building. Louise was one of those students. Now, Sciences Po and other universities are under pressure from the government to contain these protests, and there remains a strong police presence at the school.
As you can see, we are continuously watched by the cops.
Louise points out police lined up at the entrance of the school. Louise has no personal ties to the conflict, but she was drawn to the movement because of what she considers to be Israel's unjust bombing campaign on Gaza.
I'm not comfortable with the silence around the genocide, and I'm not comfortable being a part and not using my voice to denounce something, especially when my school is not doing anything for it.
The demonstrators want the university to condemn Israel's offensive and also to review partnerships with Israeli universities and donors. For Louise and other students, it's obvious that they, as students of political science, should be involved in protesting.
We're in a political science school. We need to be mobilized for such questions and for such actions. The principles of international law that we are taught in this school are not applied, and we are being vocal about it and having our school, our institution, saying that we should not be politicized like that. It's really problematic.
So Sciences Po is France's most international university, isn't it, Sarah? It says that around 50% of its students are from abroad.
Yeah, and it's a very elite institution. Much of France's political elite passes through Sciences Po, including President Emmanuel Macron. He condemned the blockades. He said protesters have been preventing debate. Last week, the education minister called on university presidents across France to make sure that students don't become entrenched in their encampments, using all means at their disposal.
Comme beaucoup d'étudiants, je suis choqué de cette ingérence politique et policière dans un mouvement de contestation étudiant qui est légitime.
Hubert Lenoir is in his second year of a bachelor's degree at Sciences Po, and he joined the protest, though he wasn't among those occupying the buildings. He says he's been shocked by the political interference and police action in what he calls a legitimate student protest. For him, student mobilizations are normal, and the government's repressive reaction has come as a shock. Lenoir says that he studied the history of student protests in one of his classes.
Student protests in the past were much more violent. In May 1968, students threw cobblestones at police. Today, police are sent against students who are protesting peacefully in tents. And then there's the way politicians are exploiting such movements. In the past, youth political movements were sometimes financed by foreign communist parties, like in May 1968. Nowadays, we are nonpartisan.
He says that this is a spontaneous student movement driven by young people, though it's hard to remove the politics from all of this.
Yeah, very few students apparently have been involved in these protests, but it has drawn a lot of politicians into it.
Yeah, indeed. Fewer than 5% of Sciences Po's 15,000 students have been involved in the protests, but they've drawn a lot of attention. So partly because of, you know, the elite nature of the school, partly because of what's happening in the U.S. And then, of course, there is the politics. Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who's the head of the hard left France Insoumise, France Unbowed party, has praised the students. He called them France's honor against genocide. He's been accused of stoking the protests for his party's electoral gains. European Parliament elections are coming up at the start of June. But it has to be said that the Sciences Po students, you know, like most students in France, are for the most part quite left-leaning. Nearly half of them reported voting for Mélenchon in the first round of the last presidential election.
Non seulement je rappelle que en République, y compris dans les universités, il y a aucun endroit dans lequel les citoyennes et les citoyens n'ont pas le droit de faire de la politique.
Louis Boyard is a 22-year-old France Insoumise MP. He showed up on Tuesday and praised the students.
La lutte, elle est difficile, mais il y a une belle phrase qui dit.
I know the fight is difficult, he said, quoting a phrase that says, "The darker the night, the brighter the stars." And you, he said, are the stars. He urged the students to continue. Later on that same day, François-Xavier Bellamy, who is the head of the list in the European Parliament elections for the conservative Les Républicains, showed up at the protest to state his opposition.
La rue ici, elle n'appartient pas à ceux qui trahissent les valeurs du peuple français.
The street does not belong to those who betray France's values, he said. He was speaking to a professor. He was referring to students. He said, "We're supporting Islamism or Hamas." The right has slammed the students as Islamo-leftists, as they call them, taking the institution hostage. Bellamy and Boyard then got into a heated debate, which, of course, made it onto all the news. One of the things that Bellamy insisted on was the anti-Semitism that's appeared around these protests.
Now, Jewish student groups have alerted to an increase in anti-Semitism.
Yeah, in particular on Sciences Po's campus in Menton in the south of France on the coast near Nice. In March, a Jewish student was turned away from a debate in the Paris campus about Gaza. She was told that there were no Zionists allowed, which then sparked clashes between pro-Palestinian protesters and Jewish students, and then the government got involved. However, unlike in the U.S., there appear to be few, if any, slogans amongst these protesters, at least what I've seen, of, you know, Zionism equals Nazism, or even the "from the river to the sea" phrase, which is seen as a call to destroy the state of Israel.
So how much, Sarah, of this French movement is really inspired by the U.S.?
Well, I mean, it's easy to draw a parallel with what's happening, you know, for example, at Columbia University in New York and other universities in the U.S. and then say that the French student unrest is an import. Hubert Lanois, the student we heard earlier, says, yes, there is a parallel, but there's more going on here.
Of course, ideas and methods around the protests are circulating because young people are very globalized. But we should also talk about American inspiration for France's repressive response, even France's diplomatic alignment. Since Charles de Gaulle through to Chirac, French presidents promoted a two-state solution, a peaceful solution in the Middle East. Under Sarkozy, that line was abandoned. So the following of American methods is mostly around diplomacy and repression, and not just on the protests.
So these protests are ongoing. What do we think is going to happen?
Well, you know, for now they're continuing. The students are trying to occupy the street in front of Sciences Po, and then they get cleared out by police. It's kind of a push and pull. Mm. It's not totally clear what the end game is. So far, it seems just like a big standoff. Classes, you know, have ended. It's exam period now. How will that impact things? We'll have to see. And then, you know, will the students continue when it's summer break?
Tunnel magique, la France et l'Angleterre deviennent inséparables. L'Angleterre
So that's news footage from May the 6th, 1994. Magic tunnel, says the newsreader. France and England become inseparable. England is no longer an island. Was it ever?
Was it ever? I guess questions. But I guess this is thanks to the Channel Tunnel, right? Mm-hmm. It opened officially 30 years ago this week.
And Jess Phelan is going to take us back to that day. Hi, Jess.
Hello. So at 12:40 p.m. precisely on the 6th of May 1994, a Eurostar train delivered the first official passengers to travel from the UK to France via the Channel Tunnel. That was Queen Elizabeth II and her husband, Prince Philip. And they arrived in northern France, where they were met by French President François Mitterrand.
C'est la première fois dans l'histoire que les chefs d'État de France et de Grande-Bretagne se rencontrent sans avoir dû prendre le bateau ni l'avion.
Do you recognise that voice?
Queenie, yeah. The late Queen Elizabeth.
That is unmistakably the Queen, saying it's the first time in history that the leaders of France and Britain have met without having to take either a boat or a plane. And that day was 200 years in the making. Mm. The idea of linking France and Britain by land goes all the way back to the time of Napoleon at the start of the 1800s. And the first proposal was for a tunnel for horse-drawn carriages. Mm. So a French mining engineer came up with a design in 1802 for a tunnel that would pop up to a sort of artificial island halfway across the channel so that coachmen could change their horses.
Wow, that sounds just like fantasy. It sounds right. Crazy. It's interesting. I guess it didn't go anywhere.
No, well, Britain declared war on France the following year, so that kind of put a stop to it.
So it wasn't about the impracticalities of it. It was war.
That was one of the flaws, I think. But people did keep coming back to the idea in the decades afterwards, and especially once they discovered that the seafloor under the channel is made of chalk, which is a pretty good material for tunnelling. And by the 1880s, French and British companies had even started digging. They drilled about a kilometre and a half on either side.
What stopped them from getting any further than that?
Well, relations between the two countries were still a bit unstable, and Britain was also worried about other powers on the continent, like Germany. So military commanders thought that a tunnel would be an invitation to Britain's enemies to invade. But soon planes would be invented, and that meant that you could basically invade from anywhere. And then by the time that the UK and France had fought two world wars together, the Brits no longer thought they needed to defend themselves from the French. So the project came back on the table, but it's obviously a massive undertaking. And they spent years and years doing these cost-benefit analyses, feasibility studies.
Paperwork.
Right, yeah. And by 1960, still nothing had been built. So some private companies came up with their own proposal for a bridge. Uh-huh. And they wanted it to have train tracks, but also a motorway for cars and even two cycle lanes.
Biking across the channel? Well, could be fun.
Right. Well, it was the 1960s, so they actually added some other interesting touches. Later, they decided they wanted to combine the bridge with a tunnel. So you would drive out over the channel, then go down into a tunnel that started in the middle of the water, then come out again from the sea onto another bridge that took you to shore. And each side, where the tunnel started and ended, there would be an island with hotels and restaurants, even artificial beaches.
Whoa.
Can you think of any reasons why this isn't a wonderful idea?
Well, having been several times to Calais to take the Eurostar, I can tell you that the weather is an issue.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, as you say, on either side of the channel, English or French, it's usually cold and windy.
Yeah, but then there's also, like, all the ships. It's not like there's nobody there.
Right. It's one of the busiest shipping routes in the world. So somehow you would have had to build all these massive concrete structures in the middle of it, and then all it would take was one boat to go off course and your bridge could be ruined. So tunnel seems more complicated to build, but it saves you these problems in the long run. Plus, if you only have trains running through there, there are fewer risk of accidents, etc. But the negotiations between France and the UK were painfully slow. You had the French on one side being very gung-ho, saying building a tunnel would prove the UK's commitment to Europe. But when it came to lining up investment, they dragged their heels. And the Brits were cautious about money too, but also about how much they really did want to be tied to Europe as ever. So things just went back and forth over and over throughout the 60s and 70s.
And then so what changed?
Well, It was the 80s. Margaret Thatcher was in power and she thought a tunnel would be good for business. She said the UK would be on board if they built it with private money. And President Mitterrand agreed. So they signed a treaty in 1986 and drilling began in 1988.
And 6 years later, it was a done deal.
Yeah, which is really pretty quick when you think that it's the longest undersea tunnel ever built. In fact, it's three tunnels because there's one to go north, one to go south and a service tunnel in between. And I think it's easy to forget, actually, just how impressive it is. Listen to that news broadcast from the night of the opening again.
Bonsoir. Imaginons, si l'on avait dit il y a 20 ans, il y a 30 ans à François Mitterrand, un jour...
Imagine if you told François Mitterrand 20 or 30 years ago that one day he'd be travelling under the sea in a Rolls Royce next to a queen in a bright pink dress, the presenter says. He wouldn't have believed you. It would have seemed surreal. And yet that is exactly what happened that afternoon. Mitterrand and the queen drove in her Rolls Royce onto Le Shuttle, that's the train that carries cars through the tunnel, and they crossed over to England in just 35 minutes. Now, that's something people were dreaming about for at least 200 years before then. And now we get to do it all the time.
Thanks for that, Jess Phelan.
Mon ami d'Angleterre m'a dit j'ai trop de brume. Mon ami d'Italie m'a dit j'ai souvent faim. Mon ami de Madrid pense avec amertume à son fils en exil dans un pays voisin. Bruxelles et Amsterdam.
Sarah, it's E-Day.
E-Day, okay. Mm-hmm. I've heard of D-Day, V-Day. What's
yeah,
E-Day,
you're getting
Alison?
Warm, you're getting warm. Europe Day, come on. I was trying to sex it up a bit, okay. But I failed. On the 9th of May each year, European member states mark the anniversary of the 1950 Schuman Declaration, named after the then French Foreign Minister, Robert Schuman. Now, he set out ideas about a new form of political cooperation in Europe, and that included saying never again to war between European nations. His proposal is now seen as the beginning of what is now the EU. So today is all about celebrating peace and unity in Europe, maybe even more so with the war in Ukraine. But just how European do the French feel? I went to a Paris food market yesterday to ask that question.
Non, je m'intéresse pas du tout aux élections.
I'm not at all interested in the EU elections, says Anne, a fishmonger. In any case, power always remains in the same hands.
Ça m'intéresse pas.
Philippe, a surgeon, is buying a big bunch of flowers.
I feel European, not only French, because this is the only option for survival and for economy and for everything. I'm totally a fan of Europe because it's the only way to avoid any war between European countries.
Oui, je crois encore en l'Europe.
So you still believe in Europe?
Bah, je pense que quand même ça nous a apporté une certaine stabilité, une certaine paix.
It's given us a certain stability and peace, says Marie, a civil servant buying fruit and veg. There are still problems, of course. We don't have a common defence policy, but faced with China, Russia, the US, France couldn't stand up on its own, let's face it.
On donne plus d'argent pour la PAC que l'on en reçoit.
We pay more into the common agricultural policy than we get out of it, says poultry farmer Patrick, chopping chicken. That has to change because 30 years ago, France had 1 million farms. There are only 400,000 now, and in 15 years' time, there'll be 200,000. So we risk losing our food security. And if you lose that, you're done for. The only thing that matters in life is food.
C'est manger.
But this seller of organic vegetables recognises Europe is also a huge market. It's better being European, madam, he says. That's how it works. There are some products you can't get in France, so we buy from our neighbours.
Voilà.
Do you feel European?
Moi, oui.
I do, says Renaud, as he wipes down the poultry counter. It's important to defend a European vision on ecology, for example, or have a bit more socialism.
Will you be voting?
Oh, yes, I think these elections are actually very important compared to the last ones. We are living through difficult and uncertain times. Jérôme, another fishmonger, wonders what the point of voting is.
On n'est pas écouté, en fait.
We're not even listened to, he says.
J'aimerais m'intéresser.
I'd like to take an interest in Europe, but the decisions they make are always motivated by personal interests. I remember when they decided to change all the weighing machines for better ones. Turns out the bloke who'd pushed for that at the EU had shares in the company selling the machines. It's always like that. There's always some political self-interest in there. It's never for the people, just the politicians and their egos.
So there's a pretty even mix there, pro and anti-Europe. But Alison, that comment about the scales, is that true?
Very difficult, despite lots of fact-checking, to determine whether it's true or not. But the point is that there are genuine issues with lobbying in Brussels. And some MEPs have been rightly accused of conflicts of interest. So it's not surprising that some people believe this kind of story.
Sure.
Now, my admittedly very unofficial poll there does, in fact, correspond to recent more scientific surveys. The European Commission's Eurobarometer survey last year found that France was the most Eurosceptic nation in the bloc. And even though more than 60% of people still identify as citizens of Europe, only just over a third said that they trusted the EU and its institutions.
That's interesting, and I guess a bit worrying as we head into European elections.
And so for these elections on the 9th of June, France will be electing 81 MEPs to sit in Parliament and represent it on big issues like immigration, ecology, agriculture and trade. Currently, the far-right populist and Eurosceptic National Rally Party is leading the race in the polls. So I chatted to Laetitia Langlois about this. She's researched Euroscepticism, especially around Brexit in 2020, and I asked her about what's behind France's disaffection with Europe.
It's a shock to see this sharp rise in Euroscepticism in France, considering that France is one of the founding members of Europe. But I think it's a mix of different negative feelings. Europe as a project was supposed to deliver a lot of very positive promises like prosperity, democracy, freedom. So in terms of values, it was supposed to be a very enchanting project. But the reality is different. And at the moment, and after several crises, the economic crisis, the migrant crisis, well, Europe is very disappointing for a lot of people, because it has not delivered the promises that were at the heart of the European project. So really, I think it's a mix of disappointment, disillusion, pessimism also, because the French are generally very pessimistic when it comes to politics and what politics can do for them.
You mentioned that the European project was founded also on this notion of promoting democracy. Has it failed to deliver on that in the eyes of the French?
For part of the French, Europe is an undemocratic institution, especially the European Commission. And considering that a majority of people do not know how Europe works because it is extremely complicated, this lack of transparency means for them a lack of democracy.
What's the correlation between growing Euroscepticism in France and the growing support for the far-right National Rally? Because the latest polls show RN on around 30%, nearly double that of Macron's governing Renaissance Party.
Well, far-right populism and Euroscepticism go together because those populist parties, whether in France, in the Netherlands, wherever, they've mostly built their discourse upon a rejection of the European Union, which represents for them the establishment, a remote elite which works for big business, for the richest, and promotes mass immigration. Therefore, the end of, let's say, European Christian civilization. So considering that those far-right populist parties consider Europe as their number one enemy, it's not surprising that the success of, in France, Marine Le Pen and Jordan Bardella explain a sharp rise in Euroscepticism.
The RN, do they have a point when they slam the Brussels elite and the establishment?
They are perhaps exaggerating something that certainly is the case. The European Union has become this enormous machine which is seen by most people as only making norms and regulations. And that's it. For a lot of people, they don't understand what Europe can bring to them. And certainly, the RN takes advantage of this and exaggerates in very excessive ways the bureaucratic dimension of the European Union. Because on the other hand, you could also mention very concrete projects that the European Union has implemented. I'm thinking very simply, because I'm a university teacher, the Erasmus program. So many students go abroad and study in European universities thanks to Erasmus. I'm thinking of all the money that was given to impoverished regions in Spain, in Italy, Ireland, in the UK, I'm thinking of Scotland. So Europe does a lot for people's everyday life, but those are very invisible actions.
The far-right National Rally has a very anti-Europe discourse, but of course, officially, the party is no longer pushing for a Frexit or withdrawal from the euro. Have we completely stopped talking about Frexit, or is there still some support for that?
Brexit did have an impact on the French National Rally. After, well, let's say, the chaos that followed Brexit, the top leaders of the National Rally stopped almost overnight, stopped talking about Frexit. But some hardcore supporters, I would say, are still determined to leave the European Union. Some would like to push for a more Europhobic, not just Eurosceptic, but Europhobic discourse on Europe.
Jordan Bardella, so he's the head of the RN list for the European elections. There's a load of buzz around this man. He's young, tall, he has a big smile, he has a big profile on social media. He is much better known than the Renaissance candidate Valérie Ayer, the LFI candidate Manon Aubry, and Raphaël Glucksmann for the PS. Is that a factor?
I'm sure it is, because they are nearly invisible and inaudible. And today, to be heard, you need to be seen. And if you take Jordan Bardella and his 1.2 million followers on TikTok, well, he can reach such a massive audience, especially among young people. This is where the breakthrough is stunning, the way he can relate to young people. I mean, clearly, there is a youth privilege and a beauty privilege here. He's an icon of the media. It seems that image has replaced substance.
What evidence do we have that the French still believe in Europe?
They do believe in the values, but the European Union, the institution, I think the disenchantment is too big at the moment to feel any real enthusiasm. But despite the disenchantment and despite the pessimism and the dissatisfaction, every year cities organize Journée de l'Europe, so Days for Europe, on the 9th of May, and they're quite popular. I took part in conferences, and I can tell you that the amphitheaters were full every time, because the French like to debate. They are very much interested in talking about Europe. I'm not sure they are very interested in voting, but talking about Europe, that is extremely popular.
Given that President Macron was elected on a pro-European platform, what does this disaffection with Europe mean for him?
It's certainly a failure. He was supposed to bring Europe back into people's hearts. Well, this is not the case, clearly. He was also supposed to silence the RN and to stop their progress. That's another failure. In 2027, Marine Le Pen might be, it's a might at the moment, elected president. I mean, it seemed completely ludicrous a few years ago. Now it doesn't. So it's a failure for Emmanuel Macron. But that's clearly a French paradox, that there must be so much Euroscepticism in a country that elected a very enthusiastic European president.
Oh, so all that doesn't really sound good for Macron.
No, it doesn't. Although it's sort of yes and no, because we still have a month to go and a lot will hinge on turnout at these elections. Traditionally, it's the older, more educated French that vote in the EU elections. And that does correspond more to Macron's voter base than it does to the far right. But while older people with memories of World War II do tend to vote, the challenge for Macron will be, along with his centrist allies, to get the younger generation into the polling station. That is definitely not a done deal. Avec un peu de brume, venue de l'Angleterre, avec un peu de blé, du pays du soleil, avec un peu de sang, de l'Espagne en colère, on pourrait faire un arbre qui monterait au ciel. So we've come to the end of Spotlight on France. We're a production of the English service of Radio France International. And this episode was mixed by Cécile Pompiani.
Now, we'd love to hear from you. If you have questions about the show, questions about France, just to say hello, send us an email. We're at spotlight.france@rfi.fr.
And if you like the show, please consider rating us or even giving us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen. It really helps us to pick up traction. You can also find us on Instagram at Spotlight on France.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks on Thursday, May 23rd. Bye, Alison.
Bye-bye, Sarah. Qui leur sera conté en couleur de chanson, qui leur sera contée.